Well, I'm going to start over. Actually, so today is, what is today? Today is September 8th, 2010. I'm Rick Hansen. And to reset for the second time, last week we were talking about wholesome desires, right? Sometimes in Buddhism, desire gets a bad rap. The Buddha was very clear. There are lots of very wonderful desires that are very important to cultivate and to fertilize in the garden of the mind, if you will. And then we explored what those were for you. Because it's really important to sort out wholesome desires from unwholesome desires. I don't mean wholesome moralistically. The Buddha didn't. He meant it pragmatically. You know, wholesome is what leads to happiness and the welfare of others. You know, unwholesome is what leads to unhappiness and harm. All right. And both of those, to some extent, are a response to the feeling tone of experience. All right? As pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, we can respond with wholesome or unwholesome desires to pleasant or unpleasant or neutral sensations. And, of course, we can mobilize our desires without reaction to any sensation at all. There's kind of a category of experience where we want things that we don't particularly like, you know, including things that aren't so good for us, like, you know, cocaine addicts who just need more and more and more, even though it doesn't do anything for them. Or on the other hand, we can want to go to the gym, even though we don't like going to the gym, right? Or we can want to take a big breath and talk about how our feelings got hurt in an important relationship, even though we don't like doing that. All right, so that's what we explored. And we focused on desires that were positive, desires that led to good fruit, right? And in particular, we focused on them in terms of them feeling fulfilled here and now. Because very often we put the object of our desires somewhere out there in the future. Instead, we explored what was it like to feel already fulfilled now, or already loved and loving now, or already safe and peaceful now, right? So that one can rest just here and now, feeling already fulfilled, already satisfied, already all right, and on the basis of that, living out in a wholesome way into the world. So believe it or not, if you were here last Wednesday, that's what you were doing. All right? At least that was my hopefully positive desire for what you would be doing. So I thought today that it would be useful to just kind of unpack this and talk about the difference between positive desires and not so positive desires and how to cultivate more of the former and release increasingly more of the latter. And you know, some of the, so that's it. So instead of me giving a big talk or something like that, I thought we would open it up more for questions, discussion, your own wisdom about what are for you the important longings of the heart, important aspirations. I mean, what I've seen a lot is, first of all, that people are actually living more from their wholesome desires than they're giving themselves credit for. That's the first thing. So there's an opportunity to feel already quite fulfilled just here and now. The second thing I see a fair amount is that we, and I include myself in this, often don't create enough of a sanctuary for our wholesome desires. You know, we don't protect them, especially in the beginning, and they tend to get crowded out by the crabgrass, right, of the ordinary state of mind. And so the question then becomes, how can I, you know, I think a lot of us know what the longing in our heart is. And then the real question is, of course, how can I make more room for that to manifest in my life without straining around it, without getting caught up in, you know, craving and clinging to manifest my wholesome desires, right? Because that poisons the well. But in your own life, how can you create more breathing room for the longings that are true and deep in your heart. Right? Okay. And including how can you, you know, live them as if they're fulfilled, or as if to a significant extent that they're already fulfilled right now. Okay, so comments or questions? Great. In the back?
My wholesome desire is to make the people around me feel loved. I feel like I'm doing that.
That's great.
It definitely makes me smile.
Yeah. Makes me smile just looking at you, you know, smiling. Yeah. So if I could ask you just a quick question, what do you do to give yourself over to that wholesome desire? Because that's a key question, isn't it? You know, to give ourselves over to the better angels of our nature, in that old saying, right? What do you do to give over to that love in your heart, that wish to love others?
You mean, how do I compensate for it?
How do you surrender to it? That's a good word. How do you surrender to?
You know, experience of feeling so joyous after making them feel loved and just getting that confirmation.
Yeah.
Just encourages me. And
yeah.
If I understand your question.
Yeah, yeah. Like, for example, do you open your heart, your body, in a sense, to the feeling of love?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's a way to give over to a wholesome desire, to open up the body to it and to feel it in the body. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Feels good, doesn't it? Just to feel it, kind of. I feel it right now. Yeah, thank you very much. You kind of rescued me there. I thought I might have to give a Dharma talk tonight.
Kind of going from that, one thing that I remember somebody said at one of your last workshop, I think, at Spirit Rock, was that seek, soak, and savor. And that reminded me of what she was saying. So when you have that feeling, the three S's.
You're right.
But I think, I think the other thing for me is whatever my longing is, to somehow keep that intention foremost, and then limit all the other things that come in that I'd like to do so that I'm not overtaxed, overstressed, and too tired to really do what I want to do and be who I want to be. And that's what's so hard, because I can get so pulled away by all those other things.
It's so great, thank you. Yeah, she's talking about prioritizing, you know, making room. That would be another way of talking about making room, not letting those B and C priorities crowd out the A priorities. Yeah. Because lots of times, and that's an important point, we have wholesome desires that are B and C priorities. It's a wholesome desire to, to file the growing pile on your desk, right? Or to, clean the grime around the toaster or something, right? We all know what those things are. And then the question is, do we let them crowd out the A priorities? You know, as the saying goes, you know, put the big rocks in your bucket first, right? Rather than letting the sand and the dust and the little pebbles crowd out the bricks. Right? Yeah. Right? Okay, great.
My wholesome desire is to love somebody that's a very challenging person. A boss who micromanages. So it's been a real lesson in stepping back and listening in a different way and not taking it personally. Does he really have something to say that I can use? And if not, let it roll off. So it's a real challenge.
Yeah.
To bring warmth to that situation.
Thank you. How many of you would say that, just like you said, one of your wholesome desires is to remain kind, or compassionate, open-hearted, loving, with in the face of provocation, with difficult people, or that's a very common and important wholesome desire, and it's wonderful to name it again.
Well, it's so easy to go into aversion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What helps you stay in the, kindness place, the lovingness place, rather than tipping into aversion?
It's just a real knowledge that I don't want to harm myself, so it feels better when I'm in a kinder, gentler place. Mm-hmm. And I notice when I go into that wanting to run away or angry place, this creates more stress.
Yeah.
So that's a good deterrent.
Thank you.
One of the most difficult, challenging areas for me is in relationship to a young adult child, that you see this child screwing up in many ways, but you know that a 28-year-old isn't gonna don't get that, and you have to be 67 to begin to realize that that's not gonna lead to ultimate happiness. So I mean, it's really hard, and man, it's instantaneous. You just turn into a monster.
You're creating a monster when
I get turned into a monster.
Oh, I
see. When I get dismissed and manipulated, and I see it. I can see it real fast.
Uh-huh.
You can see.
Uh-huh. How do you practice with that?
I'm doing well with it. And I'm doing well with it.
Ah, yeah. What's your wholesome desire there?
To always just do well with it.
What's that mean, to do well with it?
Not be triggered by the triggers. And I am. I'm mortally wounded. I just hurt like hell with that. And really, it just what it's like. It stabs. It stabs you.
So given that, you're triggered.
You're triggered.
Let's start there. You're triggered. Right? Who in this room has not been triggered in the last 20 minutes or last 20 days? Who in this room would like to raise their hand? So when you're triggered, right? That's where the Buddha started, when we're triggered. So you're triggered. Then, what's your wholesome desire? What's a wholesome desire?
Yeah, okay. So, tough love, that's really hard to...
Is that your wholesome desire?
I think it is.
Tough love.
I think it is. And it's very difficult.
I nominate a couple others. one is to not act out of being triggered. The first pillar of practice in Buddhism is, to name it a certain way, is restraint. Sila. Oftentimes the very best thing, the very best angel of my nature, after I'm triggered, is saying, shut up. Don't do it. Often that's the most wholesome desire we can authentically mobilize right then and there, right? Is don't do it. Don't throw a log on the fire. Keep in mind just what you said, that will backfire big time, as well as harm others. Just do nothing. Right? So others, Linda, do you want to add?
I heard recently someone say ABC, be aware, be with compassion.
Mm.
ABC.
Mm-hmm.
If we can remember that, then we slow it down.
Those are wholesome desires, to be aware, right?
Mm-hmm.
To be with what's there mindfully, and then to have compassion for oneself, for others, and so forth. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right, others. Yeah. Tessa? Tressa?
I have a wholesome desire, I believe it is, to not suffer around the non-existence and that sense of self and I. I'm having a hard time. I would like to be free from that suffering.
The suffering of non-existence or the fear of non-existence?
Yes.
You mean related to the death of the body?
That's right.
Yeah. How have you worked with that? I mean, what's been helpful to you?
Nothing's been real helpful, or I wouldn't still be aspiring to that. I try to go back to knowing that I'm just part of the ocean, that concept, and put that in my mind, and then just reflect and meditate on that. And so I can calm myself down. It's not like I'm out there crazy about it, but I can calm into that sense of being part of something that's ongoing. But it's not lasting. It surfaces again, and it can't hold on. I can't hold on to it.
Yeah. Well, that's you know, one of the four divine messengers. You know, in the story of the Buddha's own journey toward awakening, you probably know that he was, as the story goes, which may be literally true or symbolically true to some partial or entire extent, either way. You know, he was a well-to-do nobleman, a prince, as it were, in a small principality. And he was coddled and raised so that he didn't really experience anything difficult. He had all the goodies in life. And one day he made his way outside, you know, the walls, and he saw a corpse that's death. He saw a sick person that's illness, and he saw an old, withered, you know, person who'd lost a lot of faculties. That's aging. And he was just appalled. He realized, wow, this is my fate as well. What can I do? And he felt completely unprepared for it. You know, because if he had felt prepared, he would have just been prepared. He wouldn't have had to go on his 7-year quest for enlightenment, right? And in the distance, though, we saw the fourth messenger, you probably know, a practicing spiritual person, you know, a wandering practitioner, right? And that's the fourth messenger of the gods. And it's important to appreciate that these are seen as messengers, as divine messengers, you know, as a communication of something profound and vast and mysterious and important. You know, the three signs of decline, you know, impermanence, inevitable, all eddies disperse one way or another, and eventually. And yet also a messenger of renewal and a wakefulness and a way to be with all that that doesn't suffer those facts. So that's where we start, right? And I have two sort of reflections about what you're saying. I think there are many ways to practice with death. And Buddhism, like I think the other great teaching traditions in the world, we could call them religions, have all grappled with this question, right? And so I'm not trying to summarize all that in just the two thoughts I have or two things I'd like to offer here. Kind of intermediately and then more ultimately, you know. Intermediately, the body is an animal, you know. Right? Mary Oliver, I think the poet, has this line, the soft animal of the body. Mm-hmm. Right? It's a little animal. It's a little squirrel. It's a little baby rat. It's a little sweet marmot, you know, a little hamster. And it just wants to live. It wants to gather its nuts and have babies and have them live and have it be okay, you know, and make it through the winter and dodge the owls and the coyotes and the snakes and just keep going, right? The body wants to keep going. And then layered on top of that is, of course, a lot of personal history around feeling anxious about various things or frustrated, kind of automatically anxious, right? And I think intermediately, and we've been doing more and more of this in here. I did some of it in the guided instructions tonight. It's to try to help the body realize that it's all right, that it's okay, Right now, here and now, it's all right. It's not perfect, you know, but it's all right. It's basically okay. It's not threatened. It's basically fulfilled, and it belongs. You know, there's the opportunity, therefore, for peace, for gladness, and for love. Right now. And the re-experiencing of that in the body, in the heart, again and again and again, can gradually help calm that little squirrel down. Right? So it's less freaked. It's more freaked than it needs to be. You know, right? You see what I'm talking about? And increasingly, what that does is it takes you more and more into the present moment, the now, where it's all right. It's all right in the now. So that's... Okay? Did you see what I'm getting at? The body is sort of... It's twitchy. It's freaked. And we want to help calm it down. It's okay. You know, bombs are not falling. Air is here to be breathed. It's fed. Right? Yeah. And then I'll do my second point. Yeah.
Well, I had an experience with death about 5 years ago. And it goes along the, I guess, thoughts of being given a gift that you didn't ask for in your life. And it seemed like it was going to be a horrific experience for me. Both my parents were really declining in health very rapidly. And I don't have any siblings, and I'm in this country alone by myself. And I was very close to my father in particular. And he decided he wanted to stop taking his medications, which would have ended his life for certain. And, you know, at first I was panicked and horrified and begged and cried. And you know, he explained to me his reasons for doing it, which were very valid. And then I slept on it at night, and suddenly it became clear to me that my job was to fulfill his wishes, that became my job. And I was very frightened, you know, because I wasn't familiar with death at all, and I also had this fear of death, as I think most of us do. And I spent 3 months taking care of him, and he died in my arms without anyone there. And I asked, you know, I mean, hospice was working with us, but I really wanted to be alone. And it was the most incredible experience I've ever had in my entire life. It was one of the greatest gifts I've ever been given. And since that time, I no longer fear death. I feel like I know it.
Yeah.
And I feel like he's here with me much of the time. I can just, so I don't see it as a, I forget the word you used, ending or non-existence. He very much exists. I know it because it's helped me through some very difficult times in my life lately. So that was just an interesting transition in my thinking and experience.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah. Yeah. What I was going to add, which is more psychological and less ultimate, you know, than what you shared right there, is the fact that the fear of death, right, at a body level, like the body doesn't want to die. This is a funny story. A guy tells it who's sort of at this point, I think, kind of a Zen master, and he describes his own training where he went to his own Zen master and said he'd had some recent practices where he'd really let go of the fear of death. At that moment, the Roshi, the Zen master, just this little wizened old gentleman from Japan, leaped out of his chair and with a grip of death, of steel, just started choking this guy. He fought him off. And the Zen master looked at him with a twinkle and said, "So where is that fear of death now?" You know? So it's natural to, the body doesn't want to go. And then the mind doesn't want to go either. For me, it kind of shows up as, I'm in a really neat movie and I want to know how it turns out. You know, I want to see the next scene. So I want to see my grandchildren grow up, right? I don't have grandchildren yet, but I'd love to live for 10,000 more years. I'm really curious how this planet's going to turn out, you know. We don't get to do that. At least not in this body, not in this personality. And so then the trick is, can we relate to that discomfort? The fear of death, the body doesn't want to die. We don't want to miss out on the future. Can we relate to that as just dukkha? It's just suffering. It's just discontent, it's just strain, it's just discomfort. It is just that. And then, if we relate to it as just that, and quite inevitable, I think, this side of complete enlightenment, you know, the body doesn't want to go, then it doesn't grip us in the same way. Right? If you just imagine opening to, seriously, you know, like what comes up in you when you imagine dying yourself, the last minute, the last breath, like, wow, you know, that whatever it is, that discomfort, that unpleasantness, it's just dukkha. It's just inherent discomfort in having a body. And interestingly, if we can open to, as Linda said, in a sense, you know, be aware of it and be mindful of that and bring compassion to it, ABC, then it kind of shifts. It shifts out of the dukkha mode. It's not suffering. It's not discomfort or discontent. It's just a reaction almost in the body. Do you see what I mean? And I think sometimes we need to be realistic. There's an inherent discomfort in life, including the discomfort of things ending, including ourselves. But if we can not resist that discomfort and have a mind that's like the sky, you know, that can hold storm clouds of passing discomfort, then interestingly, it stops being so uncomfortable. And I think that's an aspiration right there, you know, to meet the experiencing of the moment without resistance. And even without identifying with it, you know, it's just a fear of dying. I'm not at all trying to trivialize it. I'm really opening up to it. I'm saying, yeah, it's a big deal. I've done rock climbing, and I've been in situations, you know, they have a saying in medicine, good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment. Right? I have a lot of good judgment now as a rock climber from experiences where I found myself more than once, you know, looking at a death fall. Climbing pretty hard stuff, too, where I just got so far above my protection that I was going to hit the ground. And the least bad option was to keep climbing, which meant I was going to fall further. You know? Like, can you imagine? That's pretty scary. This body did not want to go. It doesn't want to go. Let's not kid ourselves. It doesn't want to go, you know? But right there, what is that? That's just an experience, like any other. Yeah, please.
I just want to say I appreciate the moments to sit here and really get focused and centered on what is my heart's desire and what is my deepest longing. And as I sit here, and I appreciate it, what everybody's been saying is inside of things. And I think it's helping me get in touch with that my deepest longing, is something around expressing the secret something that I have to contribute in my unique way that makes all of the set of crazy experiences that I've had in my life, and there are lots, shared and contributed to the world in a way to generate more creativity and more joy and to make the planet desire justice. Mm-hmm. I desire justice for the planet. That's my deepest desire. And without justice, there can be no peace, you know?
I mean, yeah.
Can't just desire peace for me.
Yeah.
Because peace would be dead, and peace would be suppressing. So my desire is justice.
Mm.
And that is something that isn't dead. It's something that keeps unfolding.
Yeah.
And I think it's a creative process that has me continuing to look, you know, like what? Anyway, that's...
Wow, thank you. Really, really. Thank you.
Thank you.
All the way in the back?
I echo the same thoughts there. I desire deeply peace, and I also desire justice. So in the real world, we have real problems. And my question is, when, or is it always, are we always striving for restraint? Because there are times when you practice restraint, let's say, for example, a cell phone that does not work for 5 months. And then one day I wake up and I have no more restraint. And I am out for blood. And I feel that it's justice. And I raise hell with every person I can, up every ladder that I can climb, and the storm is unleashed, and I want to kill something. And I have practiced that restraint for untold hours. And then I just go crazy. And I, as I am going crazy, I am thinking, this is not a Buddha way. This is, I want to say this is awful. I want to call myself every name in the book. And I'm calling them every name in the book. And I feel justified. And my wrath continues. And there is I feel that there's no end to it because I've practiced the restraint. So I don't know where to put that energy. And, you know, you can duplicate that with, you know, family matters and situations that go on. But you feel that you have had your higher good, really. And you've really felt that you've done everything that you can do. And then, you know, restraint goes out the window. And I don't know how anybody else handles it, but I'd like to know what you do. Because sometimes I'm at my end.
Yeah. I really appreciate you, you know, putting it out there, right? Because I think that took courage to put that out there.
I'd like to learn another way.
Yeah.
Because I don't like the hate that I feel.
Yeah.
But what do you do?
Yeah. Well, I suspect there are... more answers in the room than my own, you know. In the interest of time, I'll just offer a few quick ones. I think that was wonderful that you said that, right? Because it's common to grapple with it, isn't it? And I don't think I'm... I think we all grapple with it. I grapple with that. You know, I think when to hold them, when to fold them, right? When do you assert? When do you be quiet? You know, I feel that I have people that are very important to me in my life, and I feel like I get about 6 shots a year to influence them. Every 2 months, I get an opportunity to influence, and I better choose my spot well. You know what I mean? So how do you deal with that? A couple things here. First of all, restraint, or more broadly, virtue, right? It's interesting how we often think about it. We often think of it as having to, you know, make ourselves be quiet or even meek. And interestingly, virtue a lot, to go to what you said, is about justice. And it includes restraining others who are doing bad things, like taking your money for a cell phone that doesn't work for 5 months, right? Or you know, just letting things go by without at least naming them. Sometimes we don't have the power to repair what's been done or even stop what's being currently done, but we do have the power to name it. All right, in our own mind minimally and often out loud and sometimes very publicly, we have the power to name it. So these are restraints on them, and there's a place for that. The second thing is to really think about how kindness and assertiveness go together. They really go together, right? If you're not assertive in the beginning, it's really hard to be kind in the end. Right? That's what I'm hearing. If you are not assertive and you're used, you're abused, you're a doormat, you're walked on, after a while, you know, in the old saying, they're either at your feet or at your throat. You know, if you lie at people's feet, sooner or later you're probably going to be at their throat. Right? Neither are very good. And the extreme of the one drives the extreme of the other. So, and then you layer on top of that culture and gender and all kinds of things. You know, as a generalization, you know, men are more socialized, males are more socialized to assert, you know, females are more socialized around sort of the kindness of the two, if you will. But, so, you know, I think taking into account that is useful. For me, in my own family upbringing, expressing anger was a big taboo for the kids. Parents, you know, they had a monopoly. And so I had to really work in my early 20s, literally doing anger workshops. So I'd be pounding on pillows and screaming at people and, you know, in role play. And I had a good time. So you know what I mean? Sometimes we have to work through our own personal training on that. But for me, the two go together. And so how do they go together? How do you virtuously, right? And that becomes a wholesome aspiration. And it has actually been, for me, a very wholesome aspiration to try to find the healthy place of kindness and assertiveness and to really appreciate that both go together. It's kind of easy to be just kind. It's kind of easy to be just assertive. But to put them together, I just think that's so fundamental to long-term healthy relationships. Right, and so I think, well, what are some things that really help there? You know, I think one is to really name what's true. And it's interesting to me that in dysfunctional families, truth is the first casualty. In war, truth is a casualty. If you have a dictatorship, an unjust society, it wants to deny truth. It wants to take away the means of seeing the truth. So naming the facts as best you can name them, naming what really is the case, what naming the cost, naming the agreement, naming your own experience, at least to yourself, to me is the real beginning. And to really challenge the forces inside your own mind or in your relationships that say, that's not sayable. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's like what happens often in families or in companies or in countries. It's like it's not sayable. To be really blunt, like the taboo topic in America in the last 30 years has been class. Like we don't dare name the fact that the richest 1% of the country has gotten dramatically richer over the last 30 years while, you know, 80% of the country has stayed the same or gone downhill. Like we have to fight through the taboos, right? Very often, you know, to generalize, women have to fight through the taboo against naming anger. Men have to fight through the taboo around naming fear, that they're afraid, right? So what do we end up with? Frightened men and pissed off women. As a generalization. So that's, you know, I really mean it. I think a lot of what creates a kind of thin soup of kindness is a lack of powerfulness up front. And then maybe to finish on this one, because we could talk a long time. I'm doing a workshop with Fred Luskin and Spirit Rock on exactly this, forgiveness and assertiveness. You know, we're doing a day. We could do a month on this topic. I hope to, actually, as we move more into the fall. But especially next year, I want to talk on relationships next year. You know, like this year, Four Foundations of Mindfulness has been a big focus. Next year, I really want to go after relationships in a big way. So the last thing I would say, and then maybe we can sit after that, and, is to really feel that those other people, the ones on the phone with you getting yelled at, or the ones who really need to wake up and deliver the goods, whether they're across the dinner table or across the country or in Mumbai, because they're customer service, you know, in India, 10,000 miles away, right? Is that, and you feel it, you know, like we could feel it right now with each other. You look at somebody, look at anybody, you know, you look at yourself in the mirror, or you think of anybody, and you let yourself feel, just for, you know, you let yourself feel it, that they're suffering too, right? And they're complicated, they're messed up like you are, right? Their little squirrel doesn't want to die, you know? Whatever, they probably don't want their job. They're not happy about their job, and they're really not happy that you're yelling at them because your cell phone service sucks or something. Or you know what I mean? Or you look at, in your intimates, you look at them and you go, wow, you know, you've had a hard day. You've had a hard life. Who in this room has not had a hard life? Right? You know, and then that just touches you right there. You kind of open to the suffering of the other person. So those two, for me, are really good call-outs. You know, naming what's the case. And then really letting yourself recognize the suffering of yourself and others, that we're all joined in suffering. You know, the four divine messengers are here in this room right now for every one of us always. So let's sit for a minute. Right now, there are many wholesome desires truly in your heart. And if you like, you know, make particular room for one to feel it and maybe sense that it's spreading its wings inside your heart. Beating its wings even, and flying with you, carrying you, this wholesome desire, into this evening and into your days ahead. Thank you, and see you next week, I hope.